This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
And he's telling the truth. Okay, I think it's time to get started. What do you say? It's a little after 10. Are we all good? Good to see you. All right, so folks that are online, hello. You can see me. And you're joining about 10 or 12 people here in Grail C. And maybe, 13. See, folks are still coming on in. And those online, if you want to grab your Bibles, that'd be helpful. If you don't have one close by, you can go to a website. I really want to encourage all of you to know this website. It's just called BibleGateway.com. Great website. Has all the translations of Scripture I've ever heard of. Well, except maybe N.T. Wright's. I don't think they have his, but they have lots of different translations of Scripture, and it's fully interactive. You can type in the passage you want. Then it'll say, put it in context. It'll say, show the whole chapter. You know, it's really a very helpful Bible tool, and I use it a lot. So you'll need that, and we're going to work on 1 Corinthians, but not for a while. All right, if we get to 1 Corinthians today, it's because you guys didn't have that much to say. But we'll see where it goes. So the title of this class is called The Great Resignation, Doing and Being the Church in the World of Radical Change. I mean, I think basically in all the time of everyone who's alive in this class, the world has been in a rapidly changing set. I mean, just incredibly fast all the time. And it's getting faster and faster all along. But right now in particular, during 2 years into the pandemic now, there has been this rapid, were you talking to the dog? Yeah, that's Chief. That's Caroline's dog, Chief, right? Caroline, when you got up, Chief just sat right up like he was paying attention. He was, that's pretty fun. So matter of fact, we kind of riffed on this title a little bit on the men's retreat this year. And somebody said, when we introduced the topic, they said, well, that should be like the name of every men's retreat for the rest of our lives. You know, just this rapid change. And what does faith look like in a world that's changing that quickly? But particularly right now, of course, it is intense. And one of the places it's particularly interesting to me anyway, is this phrase. You may have heard the phrase called the Great Resignation. And I don't know if you've been paying attention to this. I mean, it was coined at the breakfast table of a professor at Texas A&M. He's an organizational psychology professor at Texas A&M. And he was just talking to his wife. And he said, it's like this great resignation is happening. And it stuck. And then he put it in an interview. And then he wrote some articles about it. And now it has really taken off. So I want to do sort of three steps to get to the great resignation, what we're talking about. The first is and I'm working on an article that was written in December of 2020, all right? So we're at the beginning of all this. But it's an article that says the most obvious things. You know, it was just like, what happens when we hit a crisis like a pandemic? And the most obvious observation about that is, like any other crisis in your life, anything that comes, a job change, a death in your family, or some health care, you know, drama you have to deal with, it's this moment when you pause and you reassess. You reassess sort of everything you're doing. You reassess your values. You reassess what's going on in your life. So in December 2020, Jamie DeCamari did some research on this. And they found that as of June, 22% of American adults had either moved because of the pandemic or knew someone who had. Well, that is a pretty dramatic response. But you think about it, the pandemic shut down everything, right? And it shut down people's jobs. And so there was this relocation of people. And then also workplaces began to change dramatically. Some people didn't come to work. Just here at St. David's, we basically, the only people that were on the property for a long time were the sextons and the school and Trinity Center outside. That was it. And that is dramatically different. I mean, before the pandemic, this building is a hive. You know, it's just a buzz all the time. There's somebody kind of in the corners all the time, classrooms, meetings, and even things that didn't have a single thing to do with the church, just outside organizations coming to do their thing here. So it was a massive shift here. And so that, of course, made people begin to reconsider employment, right? You know, do I get to keep my job? It may have been against their will. Lots of people were laid off. Lots of people were furloughed. Again, here at St. David's, we were able to hang on to everybody for the first full year of that pandemic. I mean, but due to your generosity as much as anything else. But then now here we are, you know, 2 years plus into this, and we're adjusting some things in HR simply because of a kind of a permanent change in the landscape of the life of the church. And so this was going on across the country in every way. It's also a time, in this article, he talks about coronavirus as a place that reminded people of their own mortality. And they, you know, much like natural disasters and, you know, near misses, car crashes that you almost died in, or the tornado that took out the house next to yours, but not yours, you know, those kinds of things. It was just a sort of rethinking, and what are my values? What's important? It shifted relationships. It talked about in this article, it talked about people's sort of the increase in purchases of wedding rings and increase in breakups, right? So sort of it people were deciding, you know, they just weren't going to keep doing the same thing they've been doing all this time. They were going to make some changes and do things that were a little bit different. Also a high increase in mental health issues, you know, of sort of depression and anxiety went up, and a drop in birth rate too, which is, and that was true in the pandemic in 2018 and in 1918, and it's true now, a drop in birth rates. So that's sort of the foundation for this beginning of this thing called the Great Resignation, is that when the pandemic began, we all began to reassess our lives. And you know, I was wondering if we could have a discussion. I don't know if we can, how this works. Oh, so for those of you in the room, if you want to talk, we ask you to come to the mic, which is not really pandemic safe, I guess. You know, if you come to the mic, wear your mask, please, and use your mask at the mic, because you're going to put different people in that same cloud, right? But just think about your own life. And what are the things that you did differently? What are the things that the pandemic has caused you to reassess? And if you want to share, I'd love to hear. Yeah, I'm not in a hurry. I've got till 11 o'clock. So these open questions are really just an exercise of how long can the extroverts sit quietly. The answer is not very long, usually. Angela's coming to the microphone. Yeah. See, extroverts can't sit quietly.
I think for me, it was like real intentionality about where I wanted to spend my time. And so family became much more important, as well as my own spiritual and mental health. And physical as well. So just a real focus on that, wanting to spend more time outdoors and being really intentional about that. So, right. Those are some of the things that I reassessed and, you know, and bore fruits from it as well.
Right. So. Very good. Thank you. We want to get really honest. How many of us gained weight during the pandemic? I'll raise my hand. How many got more fit during the pandemic? Yeah. Great. See, yeah.
Hi, I'm Diane. And I think, you know, because I had to work from home, I found myself initially working too many hours.
Oh,
and
okay.
I realized that had to stop. And I set boundaries to turn the work laptop off. And I got to spend more time with my family because it was my little pod. And that has been really good for my soul.
Right.
And also because I didn't have to commute, I had more time to do things like some of my spiritual reading that I hadn't had a chance to do.
Right.
So in some ways it's been good. I mean, it's been hard, but in some ways it's also been a positive experience.
Right. Very good. Very good. Thank you. Yes. Come on.
I'm not your extrovert.
put it up over your mouth while you're talking. Oh, yeah, okay. That's right.
Let's see. I think for me, I was home with my husband. We're both retired and we're both sort of relatively newlywed. And it made me realize in a non-theoretical way that your spouse doesn't meet all your needs. And it made
me. Has he heard you say this out loud?
So why is the person I don't meet all his days over.
Yeah. Now back to 1 Corinthians.
The sepulcher that is, that it made, it just emphasized to me that, you know, I'm on the, my spiritual journey continues.
Right.
Whatever's going on in my life.
And right.
So that was important realization for me.
Right. That's, you know, you bring
up. My husband's a great guy.
Of course he is. I know. I'm sure. No. I think we all would know. I mean, all joking aside, all married people know your spouse is not the source of all things in your life. I mean, that's not possible. So, Dan, you were pointing. Is there someone? You mean someone's online? Okay, Caroline, do you want to say something? Go ahead.
Yeah, I do. I had a very nice discovery for me. I realized that I didn't have to go. I didn't have to join every class at St. David's. I really found that it's okay for me at my age to really slow down and go at my own pace. And so I did that. And it's just been delightful. I have time to do reading and knitting and playing with my dog and seeing my family and watching my little grandson grow up. And I've sort of relaxed into my own pace, which is a very comforting and calming thing to experience.
Very nice. Thank you. Some of y'all in the room kind of resonating with that. Yeah, very good. All right, so just I'm going to pause here and speak to, we got a lot more people online. Welcome, we're glad you're here. We've got a room with about 20, 25 people in it, and we've got 13 online. If you want to speak, just unmute and wait. If you could turn your screen on, that would help, because then Dan will see you and he'll tell me to look at the screen, right? But or because if you raise your hand on here, I'm not actually looking much at the screen, or just start speaking, just interrupt us. But if you're not speaking, just leave yourself on mute and then we'll carry on. All right, so all these different ways, and some of them are beautiful and good. And some people turn to good things that were restorative and sort of put themselves on track. Others, the increase in alcohol sales through the roof. I mean, so others making other choices that maybe are not as productive or as healthy. And some relationships grew much stronger because you're now together and you're going to reassess. You may actually address some of the issues that you needed to address, or maybe just really enjoy each other. But I have a son who works in a psych hospital, and sometimes people were trapped in the house with their monster, right? Especially children. I mean, he works with children, you know, so, and I'm not speaking of any of his particular clients. This is just his world that he's in. You know, that that sometimes kids could get away from their monster and go to school, you know, but now they're at home. And so sometimes it was quite dark and for some folks, and quite liberating for others. All right. But I want to turn. So that's the broad image of where we all, and I think we all agree that we're in that spot where we reassess and we make some different choices in our lives. But Anthony Klotz is the person who coined this phrase, the Great Resignation. And he is a professor of organizational psychology at the May Business School at Texas A&M. And he anticipated that there was going to be a huge resignation based on this, on several things. And it turned out to be true. Some of them are layoffs, right? That people didn't have a choice. They're no longer in work because their work went away. Or it changed in a way that they could not do it, right? But then there were people who began to reassess, particularly the lowest paid people in our culture. When the government rescue hit, they actually had stable income for the first time. You know, if they were gig economy workers or working without benefits of any sort, it's very low income, but it was stable income and predictable income. And so they were able to do that in a way, and it actually made their life better, which is a very damning statement about the state of the economy and the way our economy works for the poorest people in our culture, the people who are working 2, 3, 4 jobs at minimum wage. You cannot live on minimum wage in the United States, and the government money is higher than that, right? And so that let them at this very base level. There's that part. There's the people who were laid off, their jobs were gone. Then there was this part. But then there's this a resignation in order to go do something else. And sometimes that was out of necessity because your job was eliminated. And so you had to go do something else, particularly if you were in the food service industry or, you know, restaurants or entertainment, theater, movies, whatever. But then it was also true that during that reassessment, I don't want to do this anymore. You know, the thing, whatever the thing is. So I'm going to go find something else to do. But then there's a whole nother group of people and older, a lot of people who are closer to retirement age, who are a little more well-heeled, who were thinking about retirement already, have just pulled the trigger on it. Maybe 2, 5, 8 years earlier than they had been thinking about doing in the first place. And so some of those jobs that we described and others that have different topography to them will go back into the workforce in some way. But some of them will not at all. I mean, this resignation is that I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm not going to work. And so I won't bore you with all the stats in this initial. So the first conversation about this was in October of 21. And now in another article, in another interview with the same Anthony Klotz, I may be saying his last name wrong, K-L-O-T-Z. I've only seen it in writing, so I don't know how he actually pronounces it. And this is in an article just last week, on the 14th from CNBC.com. And this great resignation it's now part of the vernacular in HR conversation. And it's moving to what he is. It's now 4.5 million workers have left their job during this pandemic. And many of them will not ever go back into the workforce. And so he's actually coined a new phrase called the great reimagination, that with that resignation comes this reimagination of who you are. Starts with the individual. Who am I personally? What am I doing? The things that we were talking about earlier. But then it's also culture, I think. He didn't go into this a lot because he's an HR guy. But the reason I'm teaching a class on this is because I think this is really fascinating about what does it mean about you as in the plural. Who are we? Because people are quitting things and they are starting things. And in the church, this is a very going concern, right? Because our attendance, you know, with the pandemic, we had to shut the whole show down, right? Then we had to learn how to do it online. And y'all were incredibly patient with us, as all of us with the faces for radio had to learn how to do television, right? And we have no skills in this. And so we had to hire people to teach us how, but y'all helped us. And now we've kind of got that going. And the attendance at St. David's over this entire pandemic has been, if you take the formula, the multiplier that they tell us to take with online views and in-person views, it's stayed about the same as it was before. Some churches found that it went up, interestingly, and some churches went away. And I don't know if this is borne out, but I remember reading a statistic, a prediction 9 months ago that said 20% of the churches in America will permanently close because of the pandemic. And I don't know. I don't know if that's the case or not. The Episcopal churches in Austin that I'm aware of are holding their own. And the ones that are close to maybe collapsing were close to collapsing long before the pandemic hit. And the pandemic maybe just pushes that over the edge. So I don't know how the pandemic itself will impact that. But I am very interested in how it impacts us here at St. David's, because so that's still the case. We still got people logging on, but I can promise you it just creates a huge amount of anxiety in the worship committee every Monday, every week when we look at those numbers. We go, where is everybody? And are they going to come? Are they going to keep coming? Because how long can you not come to church before going to church just goes away? You know, I mean, So there's a concern that the pandemic is fast forwarding something that was already happening in the life of the church before the pandemic. You know, church attendance has been on a steady decline for 30 years. and mainline churches. And now it's on steady decline, even in the evangelical churches with all the cool music. They're also in decline, right? So there is this cultural move away from religiosity that is undeniable. And it's true here at St. David's as well. I mean, for 15 plus years, the average Sunday attendance has been slowly dropping, right? Interestingly, though, the giving has remained solid, and it had been slowly dropping as well. But during the pandemic, it's actually stayed level, which is actually an increase because it had been slowly dropping. So that stopped. So during the pandemic, you all and the rest of the church have hung in there, you know, with your giving, and are still participating in that. So I'm trying to connect these dots, right, between the great resignation and the great reimagination and the ongoing life of the church. So what does that actually look like? You know, I can tell you just here at St. David's, what do you call them? Sort of life situation specific ministries, like the youth, Glee, men's group, women's group, you know, the ones that are sort of to your particular circumstance, young adults, the all of those have declined over this pandemic, those specific groups, right? But the membership of the parish is not. So I'm just quite curious about that and concerned, obviously, you know, as you can imagine. But I'm really, what I wanted us to talk about for a little while is sort of what are the theological implications of this reality? This reality that the pandemic has caused a massive reevaluation across the planet, and particularly in the American culture. And the one that we're qualified to speak to is our life here in Austin and our life here at St. David's. And what are the implications of that, both for you personally, but then also for your world of influence and for us as a parish? And that's kind of the conversation I wanted to get to. And so I want to give us a minute to just opine about that. Love to hear what people think. And then we're going to move into some scripture to think about what does scripture have to offer us as we think about what church looks like as we move forward. So what do y'all think? I've kind of thrown the question out there, and I would just love to have some discussion. I'm going to look at the computer now and see if anybody online is ready to join in. If you're here, come to the microphone. Yes, please. And if you can't get to the microphone, if that's a problem, we'll bring it to you. So,
I'm Blair. I don't know if this is an answer to your question.
Yeah.
But I found with the pandemic, all of the online opportunities that you gave were hugely helpful and beneficial to me, and I got to know a lot of people that I hadn't. Before. And then I got to the point, I mean, I know this is a shared experience. All of a sudden I was like zoomed out.
Yeah.
And I work online. And so I have to sit in front of a computer all day, and I'm a very active, physically active person. And so it got really, really, really challenging because I get so much out of church and in the community and my experience. So I was feeling this push pull. And at the same time, I felt like my spiritual practice was getting deeper, and I had more space because I wasn't commuting to work. And so that became more and more important to me. And then now with life getting a little bit busy again, I'm feeling another push pull, like, oh, I need this so bad and I want this so bad. But then I have this other stuff in my life. So it's, you know, it's evolving, but, I would say my commitment and experience in church continues to grow. And
excellent.
I appreciate that.
Excellent. Much. That makes me so happy. Thank you. Yes. Yes. Hey, George. George.
Hi, hey. Robin.
Would you mind getting me some decaf? Go ahead, Robin.
I think what stands out to me is lack of community. Yeah. And I've always been in the church. And I took it for granted, the community, the touching other people every Sunday, seeing other faces, watching children grow up. And that has just been lost. And I'm mourning that. And I think it was kind of a tether for me to have the church be a part of my life. And since that's gone, and it's gone so easily and so quickly, that it's troubling to me. And a lot of things in life are done with practice. And if you stop practicing them, it's that use it or lose it thing.
Yeah.
And that bothers me about church, because it seems like a lot of people have quit practicing church. And it's kind of an unknown territory for the church. And as you said, we're already losing people. And this seems like it's just accentuated that. So I guess I need to be inspired by the early church, or by people that lived in times when going to church was not easy, and what kept them connected with the church. Because I think we've lost something huge, and I want to be mindful of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Robin. Thank you for your honesty about that. And I think most of us resonate with that, you know, with what you're saying. And I think what it's also revealed is that there was about, and I really ought to lean on Dan seriously about this with church history, but there was about a 70-year window in the American culture when coming to church was the norm, and it was the expectation, and therefore is quite easy. You know, it was just, everybody did it. We all go, we're hanging out, we're doing our thing. And then over the last 40 years, it's been 30 years, it's been moving into where it's kind of countercultural to go to church, especially in certain cities in America. And Austin happens to be one of those, where it becomes more and more countercultural to go to church. And now we have this external thing that is beyond our control that makes engaging culture, community, the way you described it, because you and I are wired very much the same way. It's church to me because I can actually, all safeguarding implications, touch you. Literally, you know, that we can actually embrace, we can touch each other, we can sit next to each other, we have a meal, we can share the Eucharist together. It's very tactile. And now this online thing is a totally different deal. And so now there's sort of these external pressures that make it difficult to do church. But difficult to do church, I think, is actually historically more common than the norm of everybody does church. I think church historically, being a committed believer, has been a challenge, right? Everywhere, both getting to other believers, you know, just transportation, communication, all that. And that's as long as, but then there are forces in the culture that would stop you from going to church, that didn't want you to worship and didn't want you to be a part of a believing community. And so I think we're going to have to, I think you said the early church, I think basically the historical church, find those times in history when it was hard to do church, and what the Christians do when it's hard to do church, and how do they, you know. Dan, did I totally destroy that, or is that pretty close?
I mean, for American history, you're right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So I want to say, as an extrovert who can't sit still,
come on, Edith.
For me, I'm a relative newcomer at St. David's. My brother had gone there, and so I had visited with him sometimes. About 4 years ago, I think I joined. And for me, I attended classes and events and things. But for me, the Zoom, I've gotten to know a lot of people better, I think, than I would have if I just saw them at church every week. And for some reason, they're in my home now. I don't know, maybe that makes a difference. But yeah. I've gotten to hear the same people in the certain groups that I've been attending. I hear the same people's spiritual thoughts. And I think I've developed a better connection. So when I see them, good Lord, if I can hug them, it'll be a huge one. But
right.
I really think I've gotten to know more people in a deeper way on Zoom than if I, because I'm a little bit of an introvert as well. I might not okay. just come up and jump and hug you the first time I meet you, but, and I might hang back a lot in a group and just kind of watch. But this way, I feel like I've really gotten to know a lot more people in a deeper way. So it's been very helpful for me, actually. But I'll be glad when I get back there.
Sure. Well, that's great to know. I mean, this is very interesting to hear our disparate experience. You know, some of it's been great and some of it's been very challenging and hard. Edith, I was just, when you said you've only been here 4 years, like, no, you've been here your whole life. That's what I thought. I just felt like, because I've, and you do, I think that's something I want to commend you and others that are on this call. I think most of the classes I've taught on Zoom, you've been to, you know, and seriously, and several of others, I see many of you that are regular attenders at the online, and that helps with this. I mean, it helps continue to build community and keep us connected to one another. That sort of willingness to leap past the, you know, past all the barriers that we describe when we talk about online experience.
I think that's very good, and God will figure this thing out with us.
Yeah. That's of course the foundation. Caroline.
Okay, I just wanted to sort of add to what Edith said. I think it's been it's been wonderful getting to know people on Zoom, and it's a different kind, it seems to me, of getting to know them than in person. And I've been fascinated by that. I mean, what is the difference when you see a person in person and you see them from home? There's some distance, I don't know, I haven't figured it out, but it is different, a different way of getting to know people. So it's been fun. It's been an adventure.
Right, good. Nancy, are you weighing in?
I'm weighing in, yes.
Yes, go ahead.
I have a variety of reactions to all this, and they're not necessarily consistent with one another. First of all, I am a big time introvert, although I'm a reasonably gregarious introvert for short periods of time.
I love that title. I'm going to just start calling you that from now on.
You like gregarious introvert?
This is our gregarious introvert.
Yeah, there you go. And when you think about those things as preferences, that's what they are. But, you know, and I have, you know, work contacts and friends and things like that kind of all over the country. And so in some ways, you know, working with them and, you know, connecting with them by Zoom or on the phone like we always used to do is fine. And I love seeing people's natural environments. I love seeing the natural environments of the newscasters on TV. So that's all good. And I mean, and maybe even enhanced. And it's nice to be able to do that and not get up and go anywhere, except two things. One thing is choir.
Right.
Sorry. I mean, we had such a wonderful experience meeting on Zoom with, you know, just staying together. We weren't trying to sing. We were just kind of connecting, which was really, really wonderful because I love those people. And when we were able to come back and sing, that was great. And then, you know, we're kind of on again, off again. And I'm usually the first person to say, I'm not coming. It's just too dangerous out there for me in my, you know, demographic group. So I'll sit this one out. And then it usually turns out that everybody's sitting it out. The other one is not touching people. I am fine about hugging most of the time. But I have some friends that while I have seen them, you know, and we've managed to get together, I haven't touched them, not even hugging, but just I haven't touched them. I would love to touch them. And the one, a major exception was when Jim Bethel was here visiting. Yeah. And before we all went to church, he came into Bethel Hall to see his old choir friends, you know, because some of us are still around. And of course, he walks up and gives me this great big hug. And it was absolutely incredibly wonderful because that's Jim and we had a good relationship. But at the back of my mind was this, oh, am I toxic? Am I dangerous? And I mean, I was much more concerned about, you know, could he get something than I would. So it's just all those inconsistent things.
Yeah. I think, thank you for calling to that. I think there are disparate experiences of this, right? It's the positive and the challenging and what you want to do, what you don't want to do. And I think the longer we move into this, the more we're weighing risk in different ways. You know, I think at the beginning of it, it was just COVID or not. But now, you know, 2 years in, it's mental health. It's how long am I going to live? How long is this going to take? You know, I mean, and then we begin to weigh what are the risks. There are other very dangerous things that we are also risking during this season. And it's not, it becomes a little less clear. And you're like, what, I'm willing to do this, but not that. You know, you got to step in and do this, even though it might be dangerous. And you know, Chris and I just made the decision recently. We clergy, the winter is busy for clergy. And then when you get through Christmas, most clergy I know pull away for a few days sometime after Christmas. And Chris and I had tickets to fly up to Basalt, Colorado. And then the numbers went back up and we're like, and so we did the thing. You know what we did. We just stressed over it forever. We wrung our hands. Should we go? Should we not go? You know, and then, oh, something happened with her mom. So should we go? Should we not go? Oh, she says go. Should we go? Are we going to get on an airplane? Or, you know, I mean, it just that whole drama around all this. So we test before we go. We did, you know, we went and it was just so anxiety producing to be on an airplane and to then to hang out in the airport in Houston and then make your connection and then fly into Aspen and where no one apparently thinks masks matter. You know, it was like, oh my gosh, this is just driving me crazy. And so finally we escaped to get to the house where we're staying and we're like, close the door, get inside, you know, and we don't want to see anyone. You know, which is kind of why you go to a snowy cabin in Colorado anyway, right? You know, so you can just be by yourself and then you get to relax and even fished in that cold, in the snow and all that. But then back on airplanes again. But the whole thing is weighing risk. You know, we just as easily could have said, no, we're not going. Matter of fact, we had just New Year's Eve said, no, we're not going to a gathering of friends in Waco for New Year's Eve. You know, because somebody had been exposed to somebody, you know, and so we had to, it was that whole way. And so I think back to some of this research, I think, I mean, I obviously don't know, I know a lot more about pandemics than I ever have in my life, but I'm still not, I don't really know where this is going or how this is going to play out. But back to this other thing, I think there, what this author is saying, there's three things that he's predicting. And one is that the Great Resignation will slow down. Obviously, there's a finite number of people who can afford not to work, finally. And so that will slow down. Flexible work arrangements will be the norm, not the exception. So that's going to be a massive change in the way work is done in America. And that, I think, has huge implications for us about how we do church. So I have a year ago gotten over saying, well, when we're finally finished having to talk to each other online and we can all be back in the same room, it'll all be okay. I think this is permanent. This arrangement that we're looking at right now, it'll be some version of this, whatever the next technology is or whatever. I think this is a permanent change in the landscape of church and the way we do community. And so when we hear Edith saying that she's gotten to know more people, this is great news to me. This is like, yes, okay, so this is working. We can actually build community this way. And we will also, you know, be downtown. It almost is like a solution to one of our problems that we had before the pandemic, which is the bigger Austin gets, the more difficult it is to get downtown in traffic. That was one of the things that was feeding our drop in attendance. Especially if we wanted a meeting, those of you who've been on Vestry or on any of our sort of executive subcommittees, you know, those meetings were generally 6:30. People were like, oh, do not make me come down. It's downtown at 6:00. I mean, that's just gridlock. It takes a full hour to get. There's actually a bill. Sorry, this is totally unrelated. You've been through Waco lately. The construction in Waco is just horrible. It has been forever. There's a sign in Waco that says Waco is an hour from Waco. And it just takes forever to get anywhere, you know, and so that was actually already the case for us before the pandemic. It's much easier now, you've noticed, to get downtown now. I mean, my commute before the pandemic, if I went during rush hour, it was an hour, hour and 15 minutes. Now it's 25 minutes, you know, and that's good news, right? So, I mean, there's going to be this new thing. So these flexible arrangements are going to be the norm. And so I think what we're going to be looking at for the, you know, a church budget, for example, over the next 5 years is going to be an increase in our communication budget and our technology budget, right? Just because we're going to have to stay up with the technology, use more tools, and make those tools more readily available to more and more people as we keep doing this. And then the last thing he says, and I'm not sure it has much implication for us, but remote jobs will become more competitive. Because as they get more of them, people understand them. And one of the other things he doesn't talk about, but one of the things that we're seeing, though, which we said earlier, is with the low pay of the lowest paid people in the country, those numbers are coming up. Those people are being better paid because they need them to come back to work. You know, and so, I mean, everywhere you go, Bucky's signed $19 an hour to work at Bucky's. You know, which is, that's reasonable, actually. You know, that's where it should have been all along, but it's where it's going to be now because the market's going to demand it. But that just was connecting to something we had said earlier. But this blended thing as we move forward, I think, is going to be significant. All right, I'd like to move our attention now, because I want to spend some time on this now, and then we're going to spend the majority of the time next week on this. So in this context, all the things that we've just been talking about for the last 35 or 40 minutes, I want to bring us now back to the lectionary, because between now and the end of Epiphany, we're going to be reading a chunk of Paul's first letter to the Corinthians. And it's just kind of interesting timing, you know, when we're thinking about what we're doing and then what he's actually talking about. So a little background on the first letter to the Corinthians. So if you have your Bible, open it up. It comes right after Romans in the New Testament. Again, you can find it, y'all. So if you read the first couple of chapters, you get the setting. There are Bibles in the back of the room if you didn't bring one. I'm sorry. You read the first couple of chapters, you get the setting. You get why Paul is writing a letter. It looks like this is not actually his very first letter to the Corinthians. He references another letter that was written to them, but it's gone. No, we don't have that letter. And we don't know that he only wrote two more, but we have his first and second Corinthians. It's Corinth was the capital city of a Roman province called Achaia, just south of modern-day Macedonia. It was prosperous and ethnically and culturally diverse urban center. All right, so the majority of the people in the Corinthian church were Gentiles. And Paul had started this church a few years earlier, and now he is corresponding with them about what's going on. Culturally, it had some wealthy people, and they get named, interestingly, in the letter, because they're the movers and shakers. They're on the vestry, and they're in charge of stewardship. And you know, but the majority of the group is not. He says in the second chapter, many of you were weak and poor, and I mean, they were sort of the margins, the outskirts. They were not the movers and shakers in Corinth that were the first adopters of Christianity as a rule. Paul gets word from Chloe and some others that things are going south in Corinth, and he wants to try to address what those issues are. And it will surprise no one what the issues are, because I would suggest that every church conflict I have ever been a part of or heard of will fall in one of these categories, right? It is sort of just the basic issues around human nature. The first issue was people were jockeying for power based on who they were. Based on who baptized them. That was their thing. Have you ever heard anybody in a church say, my parents helped found this church, or you know, we've been here for seven generations? Have anybody heard anybody ever in a church say anything like that?
as a credential. I've caught myself recently because I have been ordained a long time, but because I've been ordained a long time, I seem to say that a lot. And then I'm thinking, why am I saying that a lot? And it's really just, you're really just trying to exercise a little power, right? You know, establish a little authority. Well, I've been a priest for 30 years, you know, so you should listen to me. No, no, maybe if you've been a priest for 30 years, we should stop listening to you, you know, and listen to someone else who has some new stories to tell, you know. So that's one, is jockeying for power based on who baptized them. Was it Jesus or John or Paul or whatever, or Apollos? And then there was an indifference, apparently, to a very specific, I mean, they go to name and names. There was some very high profile act of immorality that the church just was turning a blind eye to. And this was not going to stand as far as Paul's concerned. They had to figure out what that was. If you want to know what it is, if you're titillated by that idea, go read chapter 5 and maybe you can figure out what it is, what's actually going on. It had to do with somebody and they weren't married to you. That's always what it has to do with, right? Another one was a disregard of proper Christian behavior. So that would just be church order, you know, like, well, how do we do what we do? And there was some disregard or a lack of regard for people understanding how that works, right? I wonder if it's almost like the insiders and the outsiders, you know, the insiders all know when you're supposed to sit, stand, kneel, genuflect, so make the sign of the cross, you know, and people who don't know any of that stuff. Now, well, that becomes a little bit of power, doesn't it? I know all those things, so I'm in. You're new, we'll teach you maybe. But there seemed to be some disinterest in helping people learn how to be part of the Christian community. And then there was a marginalization of the congregation's most disadvantaged members. And that, of course, is an ongoing issue for every church ever. And that's just a constant thing that's in every church life. And then, of course, there was a challenge of Paul's own apostolic credentials. They're saying that he was not actually an apostle. You know, so they start chipping away at his authority so that they can take authority. Does this sound familiar anywhere, ever? I'm not pointing anything at St. David's. I'm really not, because I think we're actually in a particularly healthy place, and we think we deal with conflicts when they arise directly and openly and honestly. But I mean, all these things, you know, that would be challenging the authority of the bishop or challenging the authority of the rector, you know, and it's usually the bishop because, well, you know why? You don't know the bishop, right? So you, the further away you are from authority, the more critical you can be of it, right? I remember when Caleb was in the first grade, I think it was an election year, I think, when Caleb was in first grade. And so they had a very elementary civics class about how the president of the United States is elected. So he came home and he says, I want to be president of the United States one day. I was like, good, man, you go for it. We'll be President Caleb. So we called him President Caleb for a little while, you know, just for fun, just playing around. A couple of days later, he came back. He says, I don't want to be president of the United States anymore. We're like, oh, why not? I was ready for the campaign, man. I was all ready to go. He says, people don't even know you and they hate you. So, you are exactly right. Yeah, so Paul started the church. He's gone away. He's been away for several years. And so they begin to chip away at his authority, right, as the one who's. And so that's kind of what's going on in Corinth. And so Paul is trying to reel him in, you know, and help them address some of these things. And he's trying to do it by letter, which is a particularly challenging way to deal with conflict, right? Just think about emails and how successful you are at communicating well what you're trying to say in a highly conflicted situation in an email. You know, it's very, very challenging. So that's sort of the context. And then, so the overall letter is actually a call to congregational unity, trying to pull this congregation together. And the reason is not just, Paul is not just saying, can't we just all get along? He's not denying the conflict. He's not denying the power play. He wants to deal with what's going on. The reason he focuses on the unity of the church is he believes it is the mark of a Christian community. And he bases it on his theology of God, that God is unified with God's self. The church must be in step with Jesus. And so we have to be in step with each other. So this is not just we shouldn't be fussing. It's taking up too much time. It has to do with fidelity. This is what fidelity to God looks like. And the way you see it is when we are together
he doesn't reference the Acts of the Apostles, but you remember in the Acts of the Apostles early on, one of the things that was remarkable about the Christian community to the secular world was, see those Christians, how they love one another. It was unusual to see people who were doing all the things that this group is not doing. They were caring for the most disadvantaged members of their community. They were working to get people involved. They were deferential to one another, and they were generous. That was the mark of the early church. For Paul, to see it disintegrating is not just a, well, we'll start another mission church three blocks away, let that one die, start another. This is a theological heart of the gospel. It means we're not getting the gospel right if we are not unified as a body. I think that's quite telling and quite important as we think about the modern church. And so the overall letter is a call to congregational unity, which, as far as Paul is concerned, is the mark of the church. And the drive for that is love. And he pushes this through the entire letter. And of course, it culminates in the 13th chapter, which you all had read at your wedding, right? Because you think it's about marriage. And it works for marriage, but it had nothing to do with marriage. He was not writing a letter to his niece on the occasion of her wedding. He's talking to a church that's imploding, you know, about how they're supposed to live their lives together. So this call culminates in a discussion of very specific things. So what time is it? Okay, I've only got like two more minutes. So let's say it this way. Your homework is go read the 12th and 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians. All right, so that's, you have the setting of what's going on in Corinth, what Paul is trying to get to as he's trying to fix the issues that are going on. And in the 12th chapter of Corinthians, he's going to talk about spiritual gifts. There are a variety of gifts. He's going to say, stop this game you're playing. Let's back up, because he says the funniest thing in the first chapter. He says, I hear you guys are fussing about who's baptized. And he says, I'm glad I didn't baptize any of you. And then he says, well, except for that guy. Yeah, I think I baptized him. Then he goes, I can't remember if I baptized anybody else or not. He does. He just says that. He's annoyed. You know, but he's like, I just don't want to deal with any of you. You got to get on the same page. So he starts with the spiritual gifts, variety of gifts, one spirit. And he just talks about all the different ways God has gifted all of us that we contribute to the life of the church. So now you can see where we're going next week. Is what are the implications of this great resignation on the life of our church? What do we do? And then in the 13th, and then he uses the body as an analogy for the church, all the different parts of the body and how the body can't function without them. And therefore we all need to do our part, you know, do our function in the body to make the body healthy. And then he writes the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians. But if I have all the spiritual gifts, he says, and have not love, I'm a noisy gong and a clanging cymbal. If I can do all the things that he lists in chapter 12, but have not love, it is for nothing. That's what he says. So that's where he's moving the whole thing. So our homework is, I want to invite you all to read those two chapters. You can certainly read the whole book. It won't take you long, but particularly focus on those two chapters. And next week, let's talk about what are the implications of the giftedness of who we are as people, individuals, and as a body, and how we pull all that together in love in the context of a pandemic and the great resignation and the great reimagination. Okay? So we'll do that next week. All right, I've got another, I can hang around for 4 or 5 minutes if y'all want to chat a little more, but then I've got to go preside at 11 o'clock. Thanks. Great to see everybody. Good to see you guys.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.